And of course, welcome to Vision 2030. I am Nalina Barada Badega. And of course, I'm not rolling alone. I'm always with...
I'm Thabile Masuku, and this is Vision 2030. Welcome to the show.
Yep, we are always available on all social media platforms. We are at Vision2030_ZA, at Vision2030_ZA. And remember to always hashtag Vision2030. And just so you know, looking forward to the show, we will be talking to Isobel Frey, who's a director of studies in Poverty and Inequality Institute.
Mm-hmm. And today we're discussing everything that has to do with inequality and poverty in South Africa. So we engaged with Isobel Frey on the challenges of inequality in South Africa. How do they link to poverty, and if whether it is possible for South Africa to overcome them ahead of 2030.
Hi Isobel, how are you?
I'm really good, Una. Thank you. How are you?
I'm awesome. So basically we engage with Isobel on the challenges of inequalities in SA. I mean, how do they link to poverty, and if whether it is possible for South Africa to overcome them ahead of 2030. Now, to first begin, what does the Studies in Poverty and Inequality Institute actually do?
Some of it is given away by the name. So we are an independent, not-for-profit research organization based in Johannesburg, looking at poverty and inequality, both looking at the empirical studies of the prevalence of poverty and inequality, but also engaging quite heavily at a policy level with regards to the kinds of policies that will reduce both poverty and inequality. We have quite a long tradition of working around socioeconomic rights, as is seen in the Constitution, and also working within SADC around issues of social protection and the basic income grant. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, I'm a commissioner on the National Minimum Wage Commission.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. Now, also on an how serious is the issue of inequalities in South Africa?
Unfortunately, they are very serious. I think that one of the issues that we need to grapple with is that the social and economic distance between people who are decision makers, whether in government or in business, and the vast majority of people who live in absolute poverty in South Africa is growing. Wow. So you have the issue of people's livelihoods and marginalization actually being their own prison, because they're not seen that regularly by people who have the ability to make change. So as in apartheid under influx control, black African people were relegated to Bantustans or homelands. So in a way, you see the same designation of poor people, keeping them away from city centers because they just can't afford to travel. So both in terms of income and in terms of asset or wealth poverty, South Africa is the most unequal country in the world and definitely in the continent.
I mean, speaking of now in the world, in the continent, how do we compare with other African countries now?
We are surrounded by other countries that share similar levels of inequality. So if you look, for instance, at South Africa's ranking, we are the most unequal, closely followed by both Namibia and Botswana. And then Swaziland, which has a very skewed income distribution, and Nigeria comes quite low after that. The reason why many people have attributed the South African, Namibia and Botswana ranking is because although we have high levels of unemployment, we have high commodities that are being mined out. So we have high per capita GDP. But the point is that the distribution at a realistic level amongst the population is very skewed. So we're making money, but the question is who's earning that money? Yeah. And it's also known as the African or the commodity curse, where you have commodities which are extracted. We don't beneficiate in South Africa, so we don't have well-paying jobs. Mm. The raw commodities go out. And then as a nation, we import them again at a high incentive, which is paid to other countries where the jobs are for the beneficiations. So it's many people refer to it as a kind of neo-colonial way of living. We export, we don't add value, we don't get value, and other countries profit off the labor and the raw minerals and commodities that we have here.
And now, what would you say are the reasons for inequality in South Africa?
It's a really complex question, and thanks for asking it. The complexity to my analysis lies in the fact that we have both historical drivers of inequality and new drivers of inequality. So we definitely have apartheid drivers of inequality, where black African people were relegated to very specific areas, both in terms of land and in terms of the jobs. And there was job reservation between white and black in general, not just black Africans. So the kinds of, from where you were born to the kind of schooling you went to, what kind of jobs you could have, and also the levels of accumulation. So a lot of the wealth in this country is still accumulated white wealth, which was never tackled after 1994, and is now been spirited away into family trusts, and there's a kind of veil around that. So you've got those historic drivers, which continue to perpetuate in intergenerational fashion. So we were in Tabanchu recently, and just talking to kids at school there, and hearing their families' histories, the status of marginalization is something which does get perpetuated. But to that, we've got new drivers of inequality. So what I was talking about just now about the commodities, the lack of employment around that. After 94, we saw a great opening up of our trade position. And so we are able to import a lot of cheaply produced goods, which get sold. And so, for instance, if you look at our garment industry, that whole sector is really closed down because of cheap imports from other countries. So the question of jobs is something which is definitely linked to inequality. Other issues are emerging, which are very topical right now, is the impact the Fourth Industrial Revolution will have on perpetuating existing inequalities. But it's also, if you look at the question of the kinds of delivery that people receive according to where they live. So even if you look at the difference between private and state education, for instance, a lot of parents incur a lot of debt in order to ensure that their kids go to private schools, because their perception, and where there's perception, there must be some reason for it, is that your returns on private school education are much higher. But even if you look at suburban Model C schools compared to township or rural schools, one of the classrooms, one of the schools that we were looking at, there was a teacher, educator-learner ratio of 1 to 80. So 80 kids being taught by one teacher, often without the kinds of textbooks, etc., and sometimes teachers being asked to teach what they don't themselves know. So IT, for instance, the question about the Fourth Industrial Revolution, in some of the schools they don't have computer labs, others they have computer labs but no electricity. So the kids just are not able to be skilled to take their place in the world, and so that's a further dampener. So if you look at wealth inequality, as I said earlier, a lot of the wealth is captured by whites from some previous dispensations, and also who are continuing to reap a privileged return on being white. And in addition to that, what you see often is that people are getting increasingly indebted. So in order to be able to afford to live, given the high levels of inequality and given the crunch on the middle classes, people are incurring greater and greater debt, and so their vulnerability becomes so high that if they get knocked by a tragedy such as a terminal illness or something like that, or someone loses their job, they are completely taken out of that middle class, and find it very difficult to get back in. So I think the other reason that we've been looking at fairly recently is that our economy is very concentrated. So very few people own either the manufacturing or even the financial houses. We know the big four or five banks. In many other countries, you have much smaller lending and kind of credit institutions. So people are able to break into that. We've been working with some business incubators, specifically the Black Umbrellas Business Incubator, for young people to actually be able to get both the credit but also access to the contracts that are being offered is, again, very difficult. So you have closed circles. I tell you that our company is kind of advertising for something, you tell Ona, and so we keep that amongst ourselves. If somebody else wants to do it, they've got no way of breaking in. So we're not spreading the growth. We're concentrating it. And unfortunately, in that stranglehold, we're preventing greater growth.
And now, how does, or rather, how do inequalities link to poverty?
Again, you see, you can't keep me quiet on these things. It's a lot more complex than it appears. Many people refer to inequality and poverty in the same breath. But for instance, one of the reasons why inequality patterns in Africa, for instance, are very varied is that you have a number of countries that have low income and are highly indebted, for instance, countries, but low inequality. So in effect, everybody is equally poor. The issue to remember is that if you want to address inequality and you want to address poverty, you often have to have very different policies. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the policies to address poverty might exacerbate inequality in the short to medium term. So for instance, if you want to increase everybody's income, so reducing inequality, you might do it in a way that actually drops more people into poverty, but you're equalizing the distribution of the incomes. I think that where they do intersect, for instance, the 2006 World Development Report. The interesting thing, so it's a World Bank annual report, and it was looking at inequalities. And shamefully, the country that was used to illustrate the opening paragraph was South Africa. Mm. But they actually came out with a lot of statistical evidence that showed that countries with incredibly high income inequalities have almost no chance to eradicate poverty because your starting positions are just so absolutely diverse. I mean, where you have people who are not able to feed themselves. I mean, in South Africa, one in four people are stunted, don't have enough food.
Yep.
So to bring those people up to a decent standard of living takes such a huge initiative that it seldom is possible to do. So tackling inequality is something which one would have to do, we believe, through redistribution. Mm. So looking at the tax system, I know we'll come to that later, whereas tackling poverty, the most direct way that we've managed to do it in South Africa is through the social grant system. Unfortunately, there are no grants for people between the ages of 18 and 59. So if you're unemployed and basically unemployable and you're 23 years old, chances are you're actually not going to become employed for your life.
Oh my God.
And yet you're raising children, you're wanting to contribute. The question is, how do you get those people who are so completely locked out of the game into the game?
Yes. Wow. Okay, we're going to take a quick break right now and continue the conversation later on with Isabel Fry.
Follow Channel Africa on these social media platforms. On Facebook, Channel Africa One. On Twitter, at Channel Africa One. And YouTube on Channel Africa Radio. Our website, www.channelafrica.co.za. Channel Africa, from an African perspective.
And of course, we are back right here on Vision 2030. Mind you, I am not alone, okay? Can you introduce yourself?
I'm Tabile, and this is Vision 2030. Don't forget to connect with us on all our social media platforms. We are at Vision2030_ZA. Don't forget to use the official hashtag for the show, which is #Vision2030. In the show today, we are joined by Isabel Fry, and we're still talking about all these inequalities that are challenging South Africa at the moment. So, Isabel, just to go back to our conversation, according to the reports in South Africa, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, and the gap is getting wider. What is hindering us from being able to close that gap?
Well, Tabila, you do ask questions that require a lot of unpacking. So yes, according to the reports, whether it's the Oxfam's recent report or the World Bank report from last year, the rich are getting richer. So if you divide people on an income level between the richest 10, well, in deciles, sort of into 10, you'll find that the people in the richest 10, the top decile, have gotten exponentially more wealthy since 1994. So those with wealth have increased. What you've seen is the lowest 30%, so deciles 1 to 3, have also gotten slightly better off, but that's because of the social grant income that was going to people who weren't receiving. And then what you've seen is that the middle classes, so from deciles 4 to 9, are actually getting shrinking. So there's a redistribution from the middle class and poor to the absolute poor and to the absolute rich, which is contrary to what we should be seeing. And in fact, I think it's important to realize that in the absence of social grants, which a lot of people are critical about, firstly, they're a constitutional right. Everyone is entitled to them. But secondly, if they weren't being paid out, we would see a much higher poverty level. Mm. Currently, more than one in two people fall below the upper bound poverty line. So that's more than half the population. More than one in four fall underneath the starvation line.
Wow.
So more than one in four of people in South Africa are not getting enough to eat. The stunting of children under five has increased. Amongst girl children, it's 25%, boy children, it's 30%. That stunting affects the developmental mental faculties as well as physical. So you might pour a lot into education, but if kids are not able to develop at the rate and absorb, mm-hmm. they'll never be able to catch that up. Those are the kinds of inequalities that start at birth and continue to exacerbate. So, I mean, one of the reasons why we are seeing the levels of poverty are firstly the high levels of unemployment.
Mm.
Again, it's a complex formula which includes both global changes in the world of work. I don't think any country at this stage claims to have full employment as a policy as a policy option. But we don't have sufficient safety nets in South Africa. Mm. In fact, if you look at our social security policy, it's premised on a 1992 Act, Social Assistance Act. So that was before the Constitution, that was before the end of apartheid, which is based on the idea that every household has one full-time white male employer.
Mm.
And so the social assistance that exists, as I was saying before the break, is for children and old age people because they're not expected to be working,
yeah.
Mm.
and people with disabilities. But there is nothing, no support for working age people. The other reason why the poor are getting poorer is because there is very little distribution. So long time ago, probably before you were born, in 1994, the ruling
party. I was born.
Sometimes I want to be older. Sometimes I want to be younger.
Well, you can receive our wisdom.
Yes.
The rallying cry for the ruling party was growth through redistribution. That was known as the RDP call. So okay. basically, we would share things equally, and therefore, as a result of everybody having access to more, we would be able to demand more. You would have more money, so you'd buy from what I'm producing. You would buy from what she was producing. And then as a result of some quite intense negotiations with people in the ruling party and business specifically, as well as some international financiers, people got scared and they said that we didn't want to appear too populist, that we're giving everything to the poor. So growth through redistribution effectively became redistribution through growth,
mm-hmm.
Which sounds like a clever slip of the words, but it basically mm-hmm. means that we keep what we have and anything that grows, we share it more equally.
Okay.
But the point is, we are now not growing. And for the longest time, our growth prediction was downgraded to about 1.2% this year. Two quarters ago, we were in, we were not growing and we're in a technical recession. So if you're not growing, you're not redistributing.
Yeah.
If you're not able to break into the economy because you've got poor education, you don't have access to credit, you can't make anything, you can't get to market, again, you are so out of the equation. And then again, we do see very high salaries paid to CEOs and the heads of businesses. Mm. The returns, there's an organization called the Labor Research Service, and generally it would take the average worker about 320 years to work to get 1 year's salary of the CEO. Absolutely phenomenal.
Mm.
And then I was looking at a recent report in terms of Africa's wealth and South Africa specifically. So we've got 5 billionaires in South Africa and 50,000 millionaires. But we've got a population of 53 million. So we've got a huge number of people in about 36% of households, we have households living without anyone employed and no social grants going in. So the question is, how on earth do people make money at that point?
Yeah. And how do they survive?
What is quite tragic is I was looking at the second quarter labor force survey, which came out in July, and you see an increase of 30% of people who forage, so hunt and fish, for their primary source of food.
Yeah.
Mm. And we are a modern economy. We have little access to land for many people. So that is others might be less charitable and call it scavenging for food. So people, for many people, despite this wonderful constitution that people talk about, the reality is cold and dark and it's not getting better.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break right now and continue the conversation later on with Isabel Fry.
When I think back to my childhood, geographically, it reminds me of a time where I was black and only black and only struggling, but at the same time, always reaching for something more, something bigger in a South Africa that was hostile.
Hello, Africa. This is 1000 African Voices, and I'm your host, Avurengwi. Join me on Channel Africa every Thursday morning between 8 and 9, and on Saturday and Sunday morning between 9 and 10. Rise, Africa, rise.
Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance.
And of course, we are back right here on Vision 2030.
In the show today, we are joined by Isabel Fry, and we're still talking about all these inequalities that are challenging South Africa at the moment.
So, Isabel, I mean, we have also interviewed the CEO of NYDA about unemployment of the youth in SA. According to him, inequalities are the reason we see high unemployment in the country. Would you agree with that?
I think inequality and unemployment is why we see high poverty in the country. And as I was saying, the levels of youth unemployment is phenomenal. Because, again, notwithstanding your age, if you look at any society, the labor force needs to be reproduced.
Okay.
So people retire and you need people coming in, bringing new ideas, innovations, et cetera, et cetera. What we're seeing in South Africa is that for that category, and these are not kids who are meant to be at school. So from 15 to 24, those who self-define as being out in the labor market, outside of the education, we see an unemployment rate of 70%. Generally, if you look long-term statistics, if you've been unemployed for a year or more, it's called long-term unemployment, and your ability to get into the labor market declines significantly because new things come, new people are coming in. We have about just under a million new entrants to the labor market every year from matriculants. I mean, one of the problems that we see is the fact that organizations and companies are not needing to employ. We were talking earlier about the proposed strike amongst the bank officials that was called off at the last minute. And sadly, many of those jobs are redundant with the drive again towards industrial sort of technology or industrialized and technology. People don't go into the banks, so those jobs are no longer necessary. And so where do people go in? Now, the state has been praised. Actually, I suppose the state praised itself in the report. No, I do work very closely with the state, but sometimes. So the state submitted a report recently on the Sustainable Development Goals to the UN.
Yes.
And in it, it said that one of its best programs was the Public Works Program, expanded Public Works Program. And this is where ideology comes in, because politics and poverty are always closely linked. Although we have a right to social security, you have a lot of people who say we can't give money to the poor where they've got to work for it. We want sweat equity. And in essence, that's what public works often is. So you've seen the older ladies on the side of the road who are picking up rubbish.
Yeah.
And public works across the world is used after a crisis. So for instance, if there's a war or a famine, public works is how you get people up and active and then introduce them into the labor market. It's not something where you have chronic levels of poverty and unemployment. So we've had people who've never been into the job. By picking up rubbish off the road, it's not going to make you able to march into Sandton and kind of get a job. And so the inequalities in terms of access to education, if you go to a private school compared to if you go to a rural school and you're not even proficient in English, even though that's the language you were meant to be writing your matric exam in, it's very rare that you're going to get a well-paying job. And so in addition to that, what we've seen, especially in the retail sector, is the increase in casualized jobs. So beforehand, even if you were a teller, a checkout teller, at a supermarket, you used to have a job for life. It wasn't the greatest pay, but it was regular. Trade unions negotiated good kinds of conditions of work. I remember Pick and Pay, for instance. I think that women workers got at least between 6 or 12 months maternity leave, which was really useful. But then what happened was that they stopped hiring permanent. Mm. So the protections that were negotiated no longer apply to you. So we basically, I mean, the reasons why the unemployment of youth is so scary is we're not reproducing the labor market. But in addition to that, in each society, people and cultures have a way of marking the progression from childhood, to adolescence, to adulthood. And generally, that involves setting up your own household. Mm. And for that, you need income. If you don't have that, we see a perpetual state of adolescence amongst people, younger people, who are getting older. I mean, for instance, in South Africa, the youth is defined until 35. In other cultures, at 21, you're seen as being a grown-up.
Yes.
But for instance, in some of the research that we've done, young men are made to feel redundant to society because they're not employed, and yet they're hungry, so they come and eat from the pot. They're often creating children themselves, but they're not a role model to many people. And so then you have the levels of resentment and anger, which whether it's manifested in completely violent, gender-based violence, some of the recent violence that we've seen that goes under the guise of xenophobia as well, that level of frustration where people don't see that they've got a vested interest in society and in contributing is incredibly dangerous.
Wow. Mm. And now in your research as the institution, what do we need to do to fight poverty in South Africa, or rather at least make it better?
It's interesting, we're doing a strategic planning and revision within SPI, and I was looking at our vision, which was eradicate poverty, and I think maybe we're going to have to change that to seeing a reduction in poverty, which is a very sad reflection. But look, I think taking stock of what we are as a country is important. So as a result of colonialism and apartheid, we don't have a strong rural peasantry as many other developing countries have. Mm. So people don't have arable land. I mean, we know that the land question is something which is still not yet being resolved. So people are, they've been proletarianized. They're dependent on cash income, which was actually introduced in order to try and get people, young black men, onto the mines. So they introduced taxes. People could only pay tax through cash. And so you see the steady decline of subsistence existence and a dependence on cash. So if cash is what is necessary, for us, it's very clear that a redistribution of cash and income is impossible. Now, the state, through social democracies, the state is like the umpire or the referee. It takes from those who have and it gives to those who don't have. It's a kind of balancing out. So it takes through taxation and it gives through, for instance, social grants or the social wage. So clinics, hospitals, schools, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, one of the great things, just by the by, is that 60% of state schools are now fee-free, which is remarkable. The question of quality is something that needs to be looked at. But so there is a redistribution already. The point is that we have the super wealthy who are not being taxed. At the level that they should. So we have been calling for a very long time to look at a super wealth, a wealth tax that comes in at income, but also that comes in on assets. So if you've got accumulated wealth, basically, if I'm very wealthy and I die, what I leave you, my son, is only taxed at 25%. Whereas if I'm earning and I'm in the richest category, I get taxed, my income gets taxed at 45%. So you can see you are less taxed the wealthier you are. I mean, many people and top businesses, for instance, get shares rather than income. So they get that taxed on capital gains tax. So there are ways of looking at the taxation of goods and wealth. And that needs to be done. But we also need to embrace the fact that people need money. In order to stimulate the economy, you need demand. In order to have demand, people need to be able to purchase. And so this whole mentality of that if you give people money, it's going to make them lazy is ridiculous. I mean, would you choose to survive on 420 Rand a month or on 24,000 a month? It's a no-brainer, right?
Yeah. I mean, you don't even need to ask me.
No, and yet the poor are the ones who are being punished because there aren't jobs. And the indignity and the shame that comes with being poor is also something that a lot has been spoken about. You feel shamed even though it's the society. So basically, our what we recommended in many of the policy areas that we operate in, like NEDLAC, is a basic income grant. So have a clearinghouse where everybody gets access to some income. Mm. And then that gets invoked in ways in which people who are receiving that can be linked to skills development. You need to be working with the corporate sector and saying they need to contribute more to the kinds of in-placement exposure to the world of work. Because for many young people, simple things like arriving at 9 o'clock, staying till five, getting looking respectable, that's not taught. And if you don't have any worker in the household who is your peer or who is your role model, those are sort of smaller things need to be looked at. I think definitely one of the things that we've been increasingly advocating for is accessible, if not free, data. Mm. So looking at the 5G revolution that the president's been negotiating is really important, because if people are linked in and connected, then they are able to bridge so many more gaps. They can apply for jobs, but also just keep up, whether it's music, whether it's culture. You don't have that same mentality of being completely cut off from society. And subsidized transport.
Yes.
If people can move and get around, then again, that flow of ideas happens, that innovation happens. I mean, we work quite a bit in Everton when there have been kids there sort of who finished matric who've never been to Joburg. Because firstly, they can't afford to get there. But secondly, they say, then I get to the Carlton Centre and I can't do anything.
Oh. And I think what's also important is, you know, when you're unemployed and you get employment, it's almost like you were out of the game. And now it's like you have to deal with now having an income that's coming. I think the first month of being employed is the worst, because you're just like, I've been so unemployed for almost like 2 years now, and now there's the salary that's supposed to keep me afloat for the next 30 days. So I think it's just those basic skills of how to also manage money that also need to be
taught. Manage money, but also people to be fair to other people in their family, because there's also an expectation that once you're earning, you can also support others who are not earning. And I mean, that's part and parcel of being in a family. But the level of what people refer to as black tax can also be quite daunting. And so people give up trying to work. The level of salaries is also difficult. I mean, we recently negotiated a national minimum wage, but that's 3,500 rand a month.
Yeah.
And if you are paying transport out of that, so on the one hand, this is an example of inequality. On the one hand, it's not a living wage. On the other hand, if you're a teacher or a nurse and you are clearing 8,000 after tax, and you've got someone who looks has to look after your children full time, you've got to pay rent, you've got to pay food, you've got to pay school fees. And can you afford 3,500 for a full-time worker?
No.
So the lower middle class, the working class, are getting squeezed again. And it's a stalemate in many situations. And I think, again, that's why we really need to have policymakers who say, let's put ideology aside. Let's look at making this country work. I mean, people were joking about the president's State of the Nation address and said that he was a dreamer. And we need to have concrete plans, but we also need to be able to allow ourselves to see things differently.
Yeah.
So not make things just a little bit better, but aim for something which is going to revolutionize our society, else we will be left behind.
Oh, wow. Now, let's get into the issue of the land now. I mean, how much difference will the land reform programs be able to achieve in terms of poverty and inequalities?
Again, this depends on so many exogenous factors. Being able to receive a title deed to a property, it will, for instance, enable you to raise a mortgage bond to borrow against it as security. Though you get lots of people who are saying that one shouldn't do that because then you might lose your house. If you look at that more rural land reform, one of the weaknesses that we've seen to date is the kind of support programs that go into that. So extension officers are the name for people who come and assist you in agriculture, sort of enable you to access tractors and things that plant. And I'm not a rural type myself. And what we see is that we don't really have very many of those. So under apartheid, white farmers got a lot of support from the extension officers, from the land bank in terms of loans that were lower than the commercial rate. That's not coming through. The other problem is that we need access to markets. So you have small farmers who are producing sort of 15 boxes of tomatoes. But for the retail supermarkets to give contracts, they want to have 70. mm-hmm. on a daily basis. You just can't produce that. So you don't have any way of getting rid of your stock and therefore growing, buying new seed and inputs in order to have a going concern. So I think that it is very dangerous for us to only see parts of the reform process. I mean, certainly access to land is an essential for people's physical security, for their spiritual and psychological security. Mm. But just giving a title deed without the necessary support is certainly going to be almost dangerous in a way. And so the question is also what people want land for. So I think consultation with people as to what they want. Do you want to live on a piece of land? Do you want to make it into a going concern? And the other thing that we've seen in some areas in the Western Cape, this was about 15 years ago, is that people were given RDP houses, but the municipality was raising taxes, rates and taxes against them. People couldn't afford those. And so those houses got dispossessed and sold on public auction. And so people were then told, you had a house, you can't have a housing subsidy. Mm. And you've got a debt of like 10,000 rand that you still have to pay the municipality.
Shame.
You want some good news? I know, I'm sorry.
But these are things that are facing modern day South Africans each and every day. So what is that one advice you give South African government to do in order to win the fight against inequality, poverty in the country?
Just one.
Yes. It can be two, it can be three, it can be four.
I think to think the unthinkable, because often we get told that we can't possibly do this because it's never been done anywhere else. Increasingly with people that I'm talking to, whether in the trade union movement or whether in business as well as civil society and government, we're looking at having to grasp some awful realities. So the realities are that our economy is not going to grow. As it is. The reality is we will either embrace the fourth industrial revolution in a very positive way, or as a country, we'll be left far behind, behind countries like China, some of the Latin American countries that are embracing it. So we need to see ourselves in a situation of success where everybody is linked in and everybody is able to feed themselves. Mm. Now, that's probably not going to happen through the spinach that your grandmother grows, but... And so you do need to look at alternative forms such as income. That can encourage growing cooperatives. I mean, the question of urban agriculture is growing. It's amazing. I mean, in Braamfontein, I think you've got one garden, a roof garden. But I mean, those would be more exciting if people had money to buy. So it's about thinking ahead, but dealing with the here and now. So planning for the future, but making sure at least that everybody has enough food to not go to bed hungry.
And then lastly, we just want to know, Sustainable Development Goals are looking at fighting poverty and inequalities ahead of 2030. So are you hopeful that this goal can be achieved ahead of 2030?
It's not just the Sustainable Development Goals, but it is also the National Development Plan. National Development Plan said it would reduce poverty by 2030 and reduce inequality. Now, here is an interesting fact. I know that we are coming close to the end of this program, but in the last State of the Nation address, the president dropped the aim for addressing poverty from the middle poverty line to the lowest poverty line.
Yeah.
So instead of saying that everyone would fall above the middle poverty line, now it's everyone will fall below the lowest poverty line. So that's quite a shift. The other thing is that in terms of our own national goals, the NDP, which fits into the Sustainable Development Goals, we've said that we want to reduce inequality from 0.69 on the Gini to 0.6. Now, that is still an outlier globally. Mm. So we need to ask ourselves, why are we not more adamant that we have to solve for inequality? Mm. It's as if we want to make it a little bit more palatable, but we are saying that inequality really exists. This is what I'm saying about the social distance between those who make the plans and those who live reality. So I do not see that we are going to meet those goals. If you look at StatsSA's indicators since the adoption of the NDP in 2012, we've gotten worse on both poverty and inequality. I think we need to realize that we can solve for it, but we need to think very differently, and everybody has to contribute to it. Poor people feel poverty every day. The middle class and the wealthy need to feel their contribution to ending it. And we shouldn't be told that capital is going to flee, that skills are going to flee. If we do that, our country is going to be denuded of any ability to turn around. And like many of the other countries on our borders, we're going to have the best of the youth leaving because they don't see a future in this country. So it can be done. We just need to be proudly developmental. That's my new strap line. Proudly developmental.
Proudly developmental. Thank you so much, Isabel, for coming through to Vision 2030 and sharing all your knowledge. I think the one thing that I appreciate the most is that we have people in the country who still have hope. Because when we speak to a lot of people, you find them saying, nah, I just want to leave. I just want to go. And it's like, if we meeting every day, South Africans like me and you, we have hope that this country is going to be okay. Absolutely. Or even better.
Much better. Not much okay. Better. It is going to be darn good.
Yes. But, you know, before we close off the show, we always do have the quote of the day. Oh, now what's happening with that?
Well, quote of the day today is from Nelson Mandela. As long as poverty, injustice and gross inequality persist in our world, none of us can truly rest.
None of us can truly rest. Yeah. Thank you so much to each and every single one of you for all your tweets and messages and for definitely tuning into Vision 2030. We're back again next week on Tuesday from 10 a.m. to 11 p.m. Central African Time.
Yeah. I am Unalin Navarra Tapeteke. Sloso Watlakutlukholeya Marisanyana Ngwana Mampitika Kasirete.
And I am Thabile Masugu, and this has been another edition of Vision 2030. Thank you so much for tuning into Vision 2030. We're back again, like I said, next week. Next up is economics and sports.